This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.
Welcome to a recap of our latest Third Thursday webinar. Hear directly from expert panelists as they discuss Parkinson's research and answer your questions about living with the disease. Join us live next time by registering for an upcoming webinar at michaeljfox.org.
Hi, and welcome to the Michael J. Fox Foundation webinar. I'm Katie Koppel, Senior Vice President of Clinical Research at the Fox Foundation, and I'm also the moderator of today's webinar. We've got a lot to discuss, so we'll get started. In this webinar, we have a panel who will answer your questions about imaging and Parkinson's disease. And now I'd like to introduce today's panelists. Here today, we have Dr. Madeline Sharp. Dr. Sharp is a neurologist specializing in movement disorders. She's an assistant professor of neurology and neurosurgery at McGill University in Montreal. And one of her areas of research is MRI-derived biomarkers of Parkinson's disease. Thank you for joining us. And then we also are joined by Peter DiBiaso, a member of the Fox Foundation's Patient Council. Peter was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's at 49. He works in clinical development with a strategic focus on leading global operations, supporting optimization of biopharmaceutical research and investigator relationships. So he's coming at this conversation from two angles as well. So let's get started, and we'll set the stage by a little introduction to Brain Imaging 101. And we'll talk about the different types of imaging tools and how they're used in Parkinson's. So this is the 101 level, and then we'll go to the experts for our 102 level in a minute. At the very basic level, we can start, maybe Dr. Sharp, with you. How is Parkinson's diagnosed today? I know it's primarily clinically, but how do you think about imaging tools that could also help diagnose PD?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease remains a clinical diagnosis, which means that you have to see a physician, typically a neurologist or a movement disorder neurologist, who examines you for the signs and symptoms of Parkinson's disease and asks you a lot of questions to eliminate other things that may cause signs and symptoms similar to those of Parkinson's disease. And so in order to make the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, it's not necessary to actually undergo imaging, but imaging can be helpful in certain circumstances, and it can be extra helpful in the research setting. So there's, of course, differences in the tools that we use when we're evaluating patients in the clinical setting versus the research setting. So on this slide here, there's a picture of an MRI scanner, so that's magnetic resonance imaging. And there's also a picture of, I don't know here actually if it's a PET scanner or a SPECT scanner, but those two have a lot of similarities more than they have differences. And so maybe the thing to say here is there's different with brain imaging, there are different things that we can measure about the brain. One is the structure of the brain, so the shape of it, the size of it. And with higher resolution imaging, like we are able to do now with MRI imaging, which many of you are probably familiar with or have had, we can also take a look at the deeper structures of the brain, which are those that are of interest in Parkinson's disease. So in particular, the areas of the brain that produce dopamine, which is what leads to some of the symptoms in Parkinson's disease. So that's really for looking at the structure, so shape, size, and kind of different features about the shape and the size that can be of utility. PET and SPECT imaging are quite different in that they are really more interested in the function of the brain. So there's a number of different types of PET and SPECT imaging, and we'll go into some of the details later, in particular for DAT scan, which some of you might be familiar with, and that's a type of SPECT imaging that's interested in looking at the dopamine-producing neurons. And so when we measure function in the brains of people with Parkinson's disease, it's that we're trying to get a sense of the effects of the degeneration. So that's the loss of neurons, which is what Parkinson's disease causes, to see what effects that's having on the brain. So is it causing a reduction in the amount of dopamine that's being released? Is it causing a reduction in the amount of neurons that are still available to release that dopamine? Is it causing a reduction in the pattern of glucose utilization around the brain, which is a signal that the brain is not functioning like it used to? So those are really for a measure of function of the brain. And these are variably used in clinical evaluation at the time of diagnosis or for tracking things about the disease, especially in the context of research. But I think we'll have the opportunity to go back to each of these.
Perfect. So maybe diving in more deeply and using a focus on perhaps one of the types of imaging techniques that people might be more familiar with, Dr. Sharp, can you talk about how you use MRI in your care to help with a diagnosis of PD in particular?
Yeah, I would say that in the clinical setting, MRI comes up sometimes at the time of diagnosis, but it's actually the exception rather than the rule that we would obtain an MRI in someone that we're evaluating for Parkinson's disease. Again, back to this idea that Parkinson's disease is a clinical diagnosis. The reason actually for not using MRI in the diagnosis is that, especially in the early stages of the disease, there's really not much to be seen on the MRI of people with Parkinson's disease. We don't see really evident changes to structure, to the size, or to the shape of the brain. And certainly those changes are not really visible with the types of MRIs that are used in the clinical setting, which can be different than research MRI, where they have, you know, essentially fancier techniques to be able to measure some of these deeper things in the brain. So in the clinical setting, what I'm most used to using MRI for is if I'm uncertain about the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and I want to eliminate the possibility that there's an alternate diagnosis. And some of those alternate diagnoses sometimes have some features that can be visible on MRI. But no matter the case, it is rare that MRI ever gives you a definitive answer about any of these things. So it's really kind of an extra tool to provide a little bit of extra information. So the cases, the specific cases in which I use it most often are if we are evaluating someone who has Parkinsonism. So Parkinsonism is just a description of the symptoms that are similar to those of Parkinson's disease. So the changes to the gait, the changes to the appearance of tremor and that sort of thing. And other diseases also cause Parkinsonism. In particular, some that can have some imaging findings on MRI are progressive supranuclear palsy, so PSP, some of you may be familiar, or multiple systems atrophy, MSA. And again, MRI cannot make a diagnosis of those other conditions, but it can give you clues that you should maybe be considering an alternative to the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. But I think for most of us, if we're confident about the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease based on the symptoms that the individual describes and based on our findings on our physical exam, we would not proceed to MRI for the additional information that it provides. Sometimes it is the case that we might be considering that something like a stroke or a brain tumor could be in a location of the brain that could cause symptoms similar to those of Parkinson's disease. But again, that's really the exception rather than the rule.
An individual in the audience said that they were recently diagnosed with Parkinson's. They're seeing a movement disorder specialist who ordered a brain and cervical MRI, but only the cervical MRI was approved and the brain MRI was not. Do you think it's sufficient or is it something to push for? What do you think from your clinical perspective in terms of the types of confidence you'd like to have in diagnosing someone?
I guess it's worth saying that we all practice in different settings. In the setting where I am, access to MRI is maybe not as easy as it is in other settings. And so for part of that reason, too, things are more often or less often included in our kind of standard workup. I think as neurologists, we all have curiosity to see the brain. So if I could, I would get an MRI in everyone because I just like to look at the pictures. But that's not a good enough reason to necessarily justify it. So to the individual who's asking about this, I think that, you know, the best way to address this is to speak to the neurologist and see were they actually concerned about anything and did they have a specific reason for requesting the MRI. And if they did, then they would probably be able to justify that. And if not, then I think you can be reassured that it wasn't really necessary. Because again, it's not part of the clinical evaluation that is required to make the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease.
Thank you. Maybe Peter, bringing you into the conversation as a person living with Parkinson's and an advocate in many different settings, but including a healthcare setting, do you have any advice on folks that are facing this challenge?
Sure. And I'll firstly thank the Fox Foundation for providing me the opportunity to kind of share some of my insights with the rest of the group. I've been very fortunate that I've had great medical care and great follow-up, but I was actually early diagnosis of Parkinson's disease about 9 years ago. But prior to going forward with any additional tests, I first worked with a neurologist, which led to an opportunity to work with a movement disorder specialist. And it was at that time that they suggested that DAT scan, and we've talked about that earlier in today's discussions, but a DAT scan would be used for that. And I was very unfamiliar with that at the time. But following some research, I very quickly learned that This is one more way of narrowing down the diagnosis. And again, to be clear, as we all regrettably know, there's no definitive diagnosis for Parkinson's disease, although we're getting quite close. But I think what this really did was, you know, enable me to look in nice, pretty pictures. But once you actually go through and you know, complete the DAT scan, you have the ability to really look at a very high contrast picture of a healthy brain and a brain where you're having maybe some difficulties with dopamine uptake. So the ability to use and generate dopamine. So again, after seeing that, that gave me a little more confidence, but yet again, going back to some of the earlier concerns, it was, you know, quite frankly stated that the results of it were suggestive of Parkinsonian symptoms, which isn't exactly telling someone that it was newly diagnosed, but I think you can make your own conclusion when you're looking at some of these pictures. So again, there's still some challenges in how we use and interpret this. There's also practical challenges to a DAT scan with regards to the variation of what insurance companies will cover. And then there's really the fundamental concern that some people don't necessarily like, whether it's an MRI or a DAT scan or others, you know, going through the procedure in this big machinery. But I think it's really gained a lot of acceptance in the last few years. And now they'll let you bring your own music in and relax you and other ways to address that. So again, it's not a cure-all or one-size-fits-all, but it's another tool that we as researchers, that we as patients can look at, rely on, and use as this broader management of Parkinson's disease.
Thank you. Maybe pinging off the idea of researchers use these tools, Dr. Sharp, maybe you could address some of them. You had referenced the tools that are available for research are maybe more powerful or different approaches than are used in care. And so someone had asked about that difference, how it would be different in a research study, for example, the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative study. They're a volunteer there and they've had that done, an MRI done in research versus care. What would you expect to be the big differences?
Well, I guess there's a few. I guess the one of the reason we would consider something still in research is that it's not yet definitively proven to be helpful for measuring something that tells us anything more about the patient and about Parkinson's disease. So for instance, there are many things that people are trying to measure in the brains of people with Parkinson's disease. One is to look at the part of the brain where dopamine neurons reside and to see if we could get a really high resolution, so a good fine-grained measurement of how many neurons have been lost in order to kind of get a sense of the stage of the disease. And so there's a number of different techniques that are being evaluated for this, but none have been shown to be, I guess, reliable enough to be able to yet be used in a clinical setting to say to someone, oh, I see that you have, you know, X percent reduction in your dopamine neurons. Therefore, that means this about your Parkinson's disease, or that gives me this confidence about your Parkinson's disease. So we're still quite a ways from that. And so that's why these other tools are considered research. And it has less to do with the, let's say, the machine that is used, like the MRI scanner that is used to obtain images. So there are some differences there in terms of the kind of resolution of images that is obtainable. But it has more to do with the types of analyses that are then done on those images that are acquired and what information can be derived from those analyses. And so to the individual, the experience of the MRI is similar. It's just the way we can then analyze it.
And is there... maybe one comment on the most exciting MRI research you're doing right now? What are you looking forward to?
I think the most exciting and I think, you know, some of the most important stuff is figuring out how we can standardize some of these measurements. So, for instance, taking a study like PPMI, which is kind of an incredible feat because it's a study that takes place in multiple different centers. You know, we have a sense that measuring someone's blood pressure, we know enough about how to measure blood pressure. Blood pressure cuffs have been around long enough that we can reliably assume that blood pressure measurement by X individual and X state with X machine will be similar to the blood pressure measured in another state by a different machine. But we're still not 100% certain about A, how to ensure that MRI measurements are comparable across different MRI scanners. And B, we're not yet certain about how reliable the analyses done on MRIs, on MRI imaging data, can be reproduced in a certain way. And so it's a lot about making sure that we have confidence in the measurements that we're actually obtaining from these things. And there's a lot of, there are a lot of efforts underway to kind of improving the reliability of those measurements, in large part thanks to studies like PPMI, or thanks to PPMI in particular, because so much data was acquired. So many people have been scanned in so many different settings, which allows us to advance on that. And it allows us to also compare results from PPMI to results in other studies to get a sense of how reproducible some of these things are. So it's really about kind of, I think, advancing our confidence in the measurements of what we're measuring.
Fantastic. And we'll come back to research participation in a little bit. Maybe moving on to another type of technique, imaging technique for nuclear medicine, which we talked about briefly in the brain imaging 101, there is PET and SPECT. And this is a type of nuclear medicine imaging. And Dr. Sharp, maybe at the highest level, you can talk about some of the differences between these techniques compared to MRI.
Yeah, so I think here we're coming back to this idea that this measures function rather than just structure like shape and size. And so I see here in the first sentence, it says imaging techniques that provide metabolic and functional information. So the metabolic piece is about how much energy is being used in different parts of the brain, which can be interesting because you can see patterns of early changes to a metabolic function, as in some regions either using less energy or more energy. So you can imagine using more energy if you are starting to have some loss of neurons and then you need to compensate by using more energy. So you might pick that up very early. And the converse is also true. If you have fewer neurons, you're using less energy. So that's a technique to measure the metabolic function of the brain. And then the other functional piece of the brain, which also relates to this availability of radio tracers. So tracers that can be seen on the images and that bind to particular things, basically, in the brain that are of interest. So for instance, we'll be talking about DAT scan. So that's imaging. I don't know if Dr. Seibel is now on the call yet.
Welcome, John.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, maybe we'll use this as an opportunity to bring you into the conversation. I'll start by just introducing our friend, Dr. John Seibel, who's a clinician and a researcher who's board certified in psychiatry and nuclear medicine, what we're talking about right now. He helped co-found the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases, which is a nonprofit and independent clinical imaging research facility in New Haven, Connecticut. And in New Haven, he's also an adjunct professor at the Yale School of Medicine. He also joins Peter in the shared experience of living with Parkinson's, so wearing a couple hats today. John, do you want to jump in and talk about your thoughts on opportunities and key differences for PET and SPECT?
Sure. Yeah, PET and SPECT are, as you heard earlier, tools for imaging the brain, and they both basically work the same way, that you inject a small amount of a radioactive tracer. In the case of DAT scan, that's actually radioactive cocaine, believe it or not. It's a molecule very similar to cocaine. The difference between cocaine and the radiopharmaceutical DAT scan is that DAT scan lasts longer. Cocaine gets broken down very quickly in the body. But for imaging, you need time for the material to get up into the brain, to bind to the where it binds to, and then to undergo radioactive decay. You get a picture, a 3D picture out of that. And so that's a common technique used in nuclear medicine. And PET imaging is similar in that you inject a radio tracer, a radioactively labeled medication at a very low dose. It binds to some specific target, whether it's a protein or a something called a dopamine transporter, which gives you a kind of a proxy measure of the cell integrity. It doesn't, as was pointed out earlier, we can't measure exactly how many nerve cells are there and how many have died, but this gives a proxy measure of it. PET is single, SPECT is short for single proton emission commuted tomography. PET is dual proton. That is, it undergoes a different radioactive decay scheme, and so it has a little different physics of detection, but it works very similar. And all these devices are rings that take, it's like taking a picture of an automobile from all different angles. If you get enough pictures, you can create a 3D view of the automobile. The difference is between taking a lot of pictures of a solid object and these nuclear medicine and MRI techniques is that you can get a 3D picture where you can actually look inside the brain. And so you get these very powerful images, which give you a sense of how many nerve cells are present, how severe the patient is relative to other patients. And one advantage of PET and SPECT is that you can get a number. a quantitative number, and then you can track it over time, which is helpful for seeing how people are doing. In particular, as we think about moving ahead with new treatments that may slow down the progression of the disease, if we were ever so lucky to have those, and I think we're getting there, that having a good objective tool that can measure the integrity of where the medicines work is very important.
That's helpful. And you were talking about trying to build one of those pictures. Let's go to that now and show an example of what one of these looks like for DAT scans.
It doesn't look like much. It looks sort of like scrambled eggs. On the left, you see a healthy person who has what are called normal dopamine transporters. This is a DAT scan or an ioflupine spec scan, it's a generic term. And you see a sort of a area that's yellow and white. And it's at the top, it's like a round ball, and then there's a little tail that comes off it. It looks like a comma or a kidney bean. And that's a normal person. The scan on the right is a patient with idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And you can see that looks very different. That instead of seeing the comma, you see little periods, little punctate marks. And there's differences between the left side and the right side. You can see on the right side is actually the patient's left. On our left side of that patient image, we see a more intense uptake. There's more yellow and white than on the right side, which is more dull. What this shows you is that the process of changes in the brain can be evidenced very easily with these techniques because there's such a high amount of signal where the dopamine transporters are. And when you lose them, you get a hole there. So you don't take up that tracer. And we have some techniques that we developed over now 30 years where we can quantitate these images and have a reasonable sense of what can happen over time in patients and how fast these changes occur on the scans, that sort of thing.
That's really helpful. Well, you can see here, and this was mentioned earlier, that in clinical care in the U.S., DAT scan is FDA approved to help diagnose PD. And Peter, you talked a little bit about your experience. There's a comment in the chat, and maybe you could respond to this in terms of your own journey. Someone indicated that their DAT scan result came back as consistent with Parkinsonism, but it didn't have any definite answer. And is that similar to your experience? And based on what you know now, how would you interpret that type of read?
Yeah, it really was. Thanks, Katie. And I think, you know, for me, it was very much a personal journey. And, you know, like a lot of people, when I first learned of my diagnosis or potential diagnosis, I was very adamant that it must be a mistake. That wasn't due for anything that, you know, it must be something else. I don't believe the results. This, you know, how can this be happening? So all the kind of fear, guilt, concern, anger that one goes through with getting a potential diagnosis like that. But that said, once some time had progressed, I was able to kind of look at the different ways to do that, whether it's a physical test, whether it's, you know, some of the work that we've talked about with other diagnoses and other triggers. But in this case, the DAT scan, you know, it sounds like the question was more related to, well, what happens if that's negative? Does that mean I'm out of the clear? You know, best I can tell, and I'd welcome John or others to weigh in, but one of the challenges is it's not definitive. There's always situations where not necessarily a false positive or a false negative, but there are areas where it's not telling the whole story. So as we like to focus on the work leading up to Parkinson's disease, it's a disease that requires many different quivers, if you will, many different arrows to kind of look and help the diagnosis. And that really is not, again, definitive. It's fairly highly suggestive of the conditions we've talked about, but it is important to recognize going into these that it's not a perfect science, very, very good for what it does. But Parkinson's is a very complicated disease, and all you have to do is look at some of the continued progress that we're making that I know we'll touch on later today. But the continued progress we made is not just relying on one indicator, not just relying on one procedure, but as part of the journey that we're all focused on.
And from a clinician perspective, Dr. Sharp, there have been a few different questions that have come in. Should people have, if they've already had a DAT scan, is there value in having it again for care versus for research? Is it recommended? I know the practices in Canada are slightly different than the U.S. or elsewhere in the world, but would it be recommended even if you've been diagnosed with Parkinson's for several years? Do you see the value there from a clinical care perspective versus what can go separately on the research side?
I think from a clinical care perspective, it's useful, especially if you're considering alternate diagnoses and only some alternate diagnoses. So if there's a strong confidence about the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, especially in the case of someone who's had Parkinson's for many years, who's been taking medications like Sinemet or Levodopa and is responding well to those medications and knowing is calling in question the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, I don't think that that's a situation where a DAT scan is required. And maybe back to this, to one of the earlier questions about this description of consistent with Parkinsonism, that's a good example of how DAT scan is helpful to measure the fact that there's a reduction in the dopamine producing neurons, but Parkinson's disease is not the only thing that can cause a reduction in dopamine producing neurons or the appearance of a reduction in dopamine producing neurons. And so that's why it all depends on the clinical reason for ordering a DAT scan. So for instance, one of the common situations where it can be helpful is if you're considering someone who has just a tremor and you're debating between the diagnosis like essential tremor, where we don't think that the dopamine neurons are involved, versus Parkinson's disease, where we do know that they are involved. And so there, the description of Parkinsonism on the report for the DAT scan and the picture showing you that there's a reduction in those neurons, or rather in the uptake of the radio tracer, would give you confidence that you're facing a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and not of, of essential tremor. But for some of these other, Parkinsonism disorders, it's not necessarily helpful. So back to your actual question, which is it helpful for tracking the disease in the clinical setting? No, I would say no. I think what's helpful for tracking the disease is really how someone is doing, what symptoms are evolving, how they're responding to the medication, because all the decisions that we make in the clinical setting are about, kind of controlling the symptoms. And in order to do that, we measure the symptoms of that individual that's sitting with us in the office, and we make recommendations, changes to medication, suggestions of therapy, and all that kind of thing in response to those symptoms. And so seeing the images would not help you make those clinical therapeutic decisions in any way.
Thank you. Maybe then shifting into the research setting, Dr. Seibel, I know that you're part of the leadership team for the PPMI study, and you're getting lots of repeat DAT scans on volunteers in that study. Can you tell us what is the purpose of DAT scan and longitudinal or repeated measures of DAT scan in a research study, and where do you hope this is going to be in the future?
First of all, I agree with my co-panelists that there's a difference between research and clinical applications with the use of DAT scan imaging. That's very important. One resonance that I have with Peter in particular, as I'm a patient, I've noticed that sometimes patients will get a DAT scan when they're very early in their disease course. And when they see the scan, it's very meaningful to them because they can see something that's actually physically changed. It's easy to compare, as you can see on the screen still, between a healthy subject. And that sort of underscores the fact that they have the disease. I went through the same thing. I denied it. I said, I'm the researcher, not the researchee. This can't be happening. I went through all sorts of things. Finally, I came to the conclusion that the universe has a sense of humor, but so do I, and get on with it. But with regard to the research applications, we're very interested in tracking the progression of Parkinson's disease. We know that it happens quite variably between patients. It happens variably within the course of a patient's clinical experience of Parkinson's disease. And we're looking for biomarkers or ways that we can track objectively the changes. And it's very hard in Parkinson's disease for several reasons, because first of all, it progresses very slowly. And also the medications are pretty reasonably effective. And when you get to a point where you can't really ethically wash out a person from their medications, it's hard to use a clinical measure to kind of track changes over time, because there may be a little medication of side effects or something where the imaging is unaffected by the dopamine replacement medications that people are on. And so you can use this as a measure. The problem is that there's enough variability within the test from a quantitative perspective that you can't use it on an individual very easily. We're doing these large studies with populations of patients who are getting scans on a yearly or depending upon the particular protocol they're in. And we have this wonderful now 12-year resource of scans, several thousand scans, that is like a fine wine becoming better with age because it's complete. And it's really just a remarkable data set. And we've learned a number of things. We've learned that the change in the rate of DAT scan is about 11 to 13% a year. So that number that we get goes down by 11 to 13% a year. But we also know that healthy people have reductions in their DAT scan about 6% per decade. So much slower, but everyone's losing these targets in the brain. But in a pathologic case of Parkinson's disease, it's much faster and much more asymmetric. And so we have to correct our data to make sure that someone who is a certain age is compared to a certain appropriate comparison. And I think that we've learned some ways to make these numbers a little tighter and less variable. And we're looking at other tracers as well that involve PET for interrogating this target in the brain for assessing these putative markers of dopamine neurons, as well as tracers that look for other things like the protein that involved called alpha-synuclein, which is a very important biomarker because it's one of the major reasons that we get symptoms from Parkinson's disease. And I would say that both these changes in the dopamine system and in the protein happen many years before patients start to get motor symptoms, start to get tremor, rigidity, or gait problems, many, many years. So there's a great opportunity here from a research perspective. We can figure out who those folks are. We can get them on the test to confirm their diagnosis, even before they have motor symptoms, and then you get them on a treatment that may actually prevent the manifestation of subsequent motor problems. So this is just a heads-turning possibility. We've got a long way to go, but it's certainly we're working towards in getting these objective markers of changes in the brains of patients like myself with Parkinson's disease.
And John, I want to tease out just one small bit of what I think you referred to here is that you can see these changes in DAT before there are enough clinical symptoms that someone is diagnosed. And so how do you see the role of DAT scan now in a research setting helping better understand risk for Parkinson's disease?
It's just a good question. And really, we're working on the algorithms now. We can't just have people go to the shopping mall and get their local DAT scan screening tests. Although you get colonoscopies every so often, those are pretty invasive. But it just doesn't make sense because the test is too expensive. So what you do is you look for concomitant syndromes that may be predictive of people who are going to have a change on their scan. And there are two in particular that have risen to the top. One is a sleep disturbance where a patient will, when they're sleeping, will act out their dreams and may tussle in bed and hit their bed partner and mm-hmm. kick them out of bed and all that sort of stuff. It's called REM behavioral disorder. And that seems to predict a change early on in patients who are going to develop either Parkinson's disease or maybe Lewy body dementia. So it's not specific, but it does enrich the number of abnormal scans in taking all comers by about, when we did studies, about 30% of people who have this syndrome will go on to develop changes in the brain on a dopamine transporter scan. The other change is that scene, which is a little bit easier to test, is a loss of smell. Sense of smell is changed in Parkinson's disease, as is in Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative disorders, so it's not, again, not specific. But we've done studies where we've sent scratch and sniff smell tests out around the world, some 5,000 in one study, and people would test their sense of smell at home and send us back the scorecard. We'd rank them and invite about the lowest 10th percentile back to New Haven, Connecticut for an all-expense-paid vacation to have a brain scan. And that study revealed again that it's not perfect. Most of the people who have the abnormal sense of smell don't have a change in their scan, but about 25% will have enough of a change that we track them over time, and they do develop Parkinson's disease in this cohort. Now, it depends upon what your cutoff for bad smell, and you have to correct for the fact that women smell better than men.
Everyone knows that, John.
That's
not in a research setting, just a regular setting.
That's in many ways. So we're looking at these algorithms or these ways to kind of figure out who these people are. I mean, it'd be great if when I developed my Parkinson's disease about 11 years ago, if 5 years before that I had a test that showed there was an abnormality and there was something to give me that would slow it down. But we're not there. But that's the vision and the dream, at least my dream.
Thank you. Maybe we can spend just a moment on PET imaging, and John already referenced a protein of interest, alpha-synuclein, that we think might be something that could be measured in the future by PET imaging. Dr. Sharp, can you talk about how PET imaging has changed therapeutic development for Alzheimer's field, and what do you think might be on the horizon for PET imaging in the Parkinson's field?
Yeah, I think this comes back to being able to use the imaging test to be able to definitively say that what we're seeing is Parkinson's disease versus something else that can have a similar pattern to Parkinson's disease. So like, as we were saying before, the loss of dopamine neurons could theoretically be caused by things other than Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. But the accumulation of certain proteins that are known to be at the root cause of Parkinson's disease, so namely the synuclein that Dr. Seibel was mentioning earlier, that's something that we know to be specific, so clearly indicative of Parkinson's disease. And that's ultimately what we want to search for in the brain. And so in the field of Alzheimer's disease, it is possible right now to measure the accumulation of amyloid, which is the abnormal protein that accumulates in Alzheimer's disease. And that's been quite helpful, especially in the research setting and now kind of transitioning into the clinical setting, because it means that kind of as Dr. Seibel, like maybe let's take a step back. With the vision that Dr. Seibel has, I think is the vision, the kind of the hope that all of us have, like, you know, researchers, clinicians, and patients alike, that we are able to, long before the disease actually manifests with symptoms, we can definitively diagnose that someone is at risk of it, and that we would have a treatment to be able to slow or, kind of prevent any further accumulation of abnormalities in the brain. In order to get there, we need to have clinical trials where it's possible to test drugs that could actually have that slowing down of disease effects. And in order to be able to support those clinical trials, we need something that we can measure to prove this drug is actually having its intended effect, and it's reducing the burden of disease in the brain. In people who are not yet manifesting the disease, that means that by definition, they don't have symptoms. So there's nothing that you can measure as a neurologist to prove that they're not progressing. But so if we had a test that could prove to us and that we could use to track whether the disease is progressing in the brain, slowing down or not appearing at all, then we would be able to prove that drug A is effective versus drug B or whatever, and which would advance us to this kind of, you know, vision of the future that we have. So that's where something that can actually identify this abnormal protein, which is the kind of defining feature of Parkinson's disease, so that synuclein, would be helpful. And there have certainly been some developments. I think one of the challenges in Parkinson's disease compared to Alzheimer's disease, which explains why in the field of Alzheimer's disease, they already have such a, you know, PET imaging tracer and we don't, is that there's less of this protein that accumulates in the brain. There's less of this abnormal conformation of this protein that accumulates in the brain. And the where it accumulates in the brain is actually inside the cells, inside the neurons, which makes it harder to also be able to image it as opposed to outside of the cells. But there's been some really interesting progress, especially in the last year, a few studies that have indicated that there is certainly, a lot of hope to be had that we're getting closer and closer to developing these PET radio tracers that could be sensitive enough to actually pick up on this abnormal protein in the brains of people who have synuclein. The other tricky piece, maybe just to add, because it's not such a simple story, Parkinson's disease has this abnormal protein. But other diseases too, namely multiple systems atrophy, which manifests a bit different than Parkinson's disease. And so there's still some work to be done to be able to, you know, develop these tracers such that they really tell us exactly the information that we're looking for. But I think there's really a lot of reason to be very hopeful that we're well on our way towards achieving that goal.
I think the hope is what continues to fuel the folks at the Fox Foundation and our partners who have been on a quest to help support development of a synuclein tracer since our inception and the protein alpha-synuclein, who, if you've tuned into these webinars before, I'm sure you're all familiar with that term. It's the protein that clumps and misfolds in the disease. So the Fox Foundation has been focused on trying to develop these types of tools to image alpha-synuclein in the brain. And we're not afraid of a bit of hard work and the challenge, and that we're going to continue to track that aggressively. Maybe now several years ago, back in 2016, we announced a $2 million alpha-synuclein imaging prize that would be awarded to the first team to achieve successful selective imaging of alpha-synuclein in the brain. You could imagine we have one of those giant size checks that come with some balloons. We're excited to share in 2020, the Ken Griffin Alpha-Synuclein Imaging Competition awarded three teams $8.5 million in funding to help accelerate work in this area. And this past year, a team from Merck was awarded a $1.5 million prize for having made the most progress with their synuclein tracer. And the team is planning to use its tool in people with Parkinson's this upcoming year to test it. And so I think there's a lot of exciting progress, Dr. Sharp, as you've talked about, and we're on the horizon, or it's on the horizon for the field.
One thing I might add, Katie, augmenting Dr. Sharp's comments, there is a way to detect alpha-synuclein. It's a blood cerebral spinal fluid test. And that test has been very popular recently. There's been a lot of research and excitement about it. It does involve a lumbar puncture, but it looks like it is specific between the Parkinson's type of alpha-synuclein and the MSA type of alpha-synuclein. The Parkinson's type is associated with nerve cells, neurons, whereas the MSA is associated with these helper cells called glia. They're sort of like supporting the neurons. And so it has a little different structure, and so you can actually tell them apart with this test. The problem with the test is that it doesn't give you a quantitative number, so you can't track people right now anyway over time. It does involve a lumbar puncture, which is a little invasive for some folks, although it's a pretty common procedure. Many of you who are in PBMI on this call have undergone that. And it doesn't give information about the region of the brain that the changes are occurring. So there's some complementarity between the PET imaging and the blood test for alpha-synuclein. So I think, like all biomarkers, this complementarity is important, because we're going to make the best use of these tools in whatever way we can.
And this alpha-synuclein seed amplification test, or the spinal fluid test to measure alpha-synuclein in living people, has been something that the Fox Foundation has been shouting from the rooftops as a major breakthrough. And this breakthrough is really possible thanks to thousands of volunteers who participated in the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative study. Peter, what would you say is the role of study participants in research and helping advance these types of breakthroughs?
I mean, first of all, I think it's an acknowledgement that there's, you know, selfless kind of focus and devotion to this really is amazing. And I've been in industry for 25 plus years, and I've never seen a more coalesced kind of charge, if you will, an endorsement of all the work that can be done. That being said, I think we can do more. It's probably the number one reason that research sometimes lags and slows down a little bit. And suffice to say that the patient is waiting, and I'm one of those patients, so I'm just as eager as anyone to get that process through. And there's also some, you know, opportunity in terms of healthy controls with caregivers or non-diagnosed patients, who's, you know, often I hear from folks that aren't, you know, a caregiver or someone that's taking care of someone with Parkinson's disease. And it's often said that, you know, what can I do? What can I do? Well, you don't have to look any further than any of the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of ongoing clinical studies that are being featured. So again, I think a real step forward is embracing an opportunity to be a subject participant, really being a research hero. And it really does provide that reinforcement to the caregivers that all of us are doing absolutely whatever we possibly can to promote the benefits of research, and more importantly, to really dig down and look at Parkinson's disease and just how much difference we've really made. And if you haven't seen some of the research over the last 6 months, it's really quite amazing. The advancements that we've made is no short of miraculous, and I don't use that slogan you know, blindly. So we're really excited to see the progress, but there's still a lot more to be done.
And with your call to action and the need for more people to raise their hand and participate in research, I just wanted to highlight that the foundation's landmark study is still recruiting volunteers for PPMI. PPMI follows participants and collects data over time. This information helps researchers and drug developers better understand Parkinson's. And I think this is a really exciting opportunity and a critical need for developing better treatments, including paving pathways to preventing the disease in the future. And now coming back to panel and topics and making sure we leave some dedicated time for additional questions at the end. There have been some questions about getting the scan and what does it take to go through this. And it can be stressful because people have to stay still in a confined space. You're sliding into this donut with a loud banging sound, or you have an injection of a radioactive tracer. P- Peter, maybe you could start by talking about any concerns you had when getting an imaging test. And if you had them, what were they? Was there anything you did to make yourself more comfortable?
I mean, nuclear medicine is a wonderful field, but to the layperson, it's a little bit intimidating in terms of how to understand that. And, you know, when it's purposely that I'm, you know, getting an injection of radioactive fluid into my body, suffice to say, I did question that a little bit and, you know, wanted to do some more research on my own. But it's well served, and it's really been an advancement that's really been in place for decades. And it really is very effective, as Dr. Seidel was alluding to earlier, with some of the work that we've seen there. So that being said, it's still a challenge in terms of, you know, these procedures. And as I briefly referenced earlier, it's not always necessarily something that is comfortable for people, but there are strategies, and you see some great recommendations here, there, you know, here on the screen in front of you. But there's some great opportunities, I think, in terms of that. It didn't bother me because I was, you know, really clear and my questions were made. I think, you know, the MRI technicians are phenomenal about making sure that you're comfortable. They're talking you through every single move that they make in terms of that. And I think it's very comforting to hear the perspective of the physician and the MRI tech that's really walking step by step the expectations, what can be done, what they're going to hear, what they're going to feel. And it really helps put the patient at ease. And then certainly having a caregiver with you for that kind of moral support can't be underlooked. But again, I think there's, you know, it is potentially uncomfortable for people, but I think with some education and with some follow-up from, you know, the neurologist, this movement disorder specialist and others, it really helps to assuage a lot of those concerns.
Thank you, Peter. And I'll highlight that this list of tips was not just generated by the panelists here or folks at the Fox Foundation. This was crowdsourced from people living with Parkinson's and the Fox Foundation's online community. And so these are suggestions that came directly from the community. Dr. Sharp, anything you'd say about risks from imaging? Or are there risks, and what are they? How do you advise your patients?
I mean, the risks are from, for instance, in the case of, well, depending on the type of imaging, from radiation exposure or from the injection of the contrast agent or from the discomfort of lying, of kind of having to lie through this procedure and potentially be somewhat uncomfortable. The risks are considered to be really minimal in the terms of exposure. They're not considered to be significantly more than what is expected from kind of everyday exposures. And so we consider them to be very safe tests. I think the limitation remains just access.
Okay. Maybe we'll now move to the final Q&A session, starting with one, and maybe I'd like a couple perspectives here from the panelists. When would it be useful to have the spinal fluid test that was suggested on alpha-synuclein versus something like a DAT scan or MRI? And maybe, Dr. Sharp, we can start with you with your clinical perspective.
Yeah. So again, in the clinical setting, we would do things that are recognized definitively clinically as being helpful. So that's the case for a DAT scan, for added support towards the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and eliminating alternatives. The CSF test for alpha-synuclein is something that is currently, at least as far as I'm aware, at least in my surroundings, something that is done in the research setting and not part of the clinical diagnosis. And so it will really have value for, in the way that DAT scan was used in PPMI, because PPMI was interested in, and continues to be interested in identifying people who are very, very, very early or before the manifestation of symptoms. And so where you need some added confirmation of the diagnosis, that's where the CSF could be helpful. But in the clinical setting, that's not part of the diagnostic workup yet.
Thank you. Peter, what are your thoughts as a person that's curious and living with PD? What would you say about a spinal fluid test, DAT scan, how you think about those two different types of tests?
I think from a pure risk standpoint and, you know, kind of concern, I think, you know, the easiest opportunity for me was really the brain scan. And as Dr. Seibel alluded to earlier, it does come up with some really cool pictures. And, you know, it's very fascinating seeing your brain sliced and diced and visualized. So I think at that regards, I think, you know, the spinal tap, I think, you know, spinal work is, again, intimidating. But I've been fortunate, maybe unfortunate enough, to actually take that procedure as well. And despite my concerns and fear going into it, the physician was phenomenal. and it was less than a flu shot in terms of, you know, pinprick. You know, there's always the risk of any shot, and, you know, you think about all the terrible things that can happen if you miss. But, you know, it was amazing in terms of how easy that was. And again, just another tool that we can use as researchers and as patients and as, you know, advocates to better understand. And there'll be many more on the way.
Thanks. And John, anything you'd add from a research perspective, the alpha-synuclein seed amplification test, DAT scan, both, where do you see their
First of all, this is a game changer for clinical research trials in a lot of ways. It's going to standardize how we approach the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. It's going to be based on biomarkers, we believe, the presence of alpha-synuclein in the cerebral spinal fluid, and maybe a blood test will be developed. We're hoping that the case, there's some skin biopsies and other ways to get it, but they're not quite as good as the lumbar puncture CSF sample. And dopamine transporter imaging, which is important because it shows you the changes in sort of where the action is, where many of the symptoms that patients have are resulting from changes in those circuits in the brain. And so between these two biomarkers, there's been an initiative to sort of redefine how we think of Parkinson's diagnosis based on the biology instead of based on a cluster of clinical symptoms. And this happens in all areas of medicine. Once you get a better understanding of the pathology, you define the disease based on the pathology, not on which doctor discovered the clinical syndrome in the 1800s. So we're moving along here, and I think that's very exciting. And we will have a very different approach to standardizing how we do clinical trials with treatments. I think the other part about developing these redefined ways for diagnosing Parkinson's and staging the changes over time is that it gives caregivers and patients a little sense of what's important to them. So in some cases, neurologists will look at symptoms of various sorts, and they may be irrelevant to the patient. But by looking at functional measures that actually impact your life, like for me, it's tremor, and trying to click on a mouse in an accurate fashion is a problem. That may not be a problem for someone who doesn't do the sort of work that I do. So having functional measures that impact the patient are really important. And the FDA likes that too, because it means that you're looking at relevant effects of the disease and relevant things that you could prevent from happening or look to get better. So I think from a research perspective, these imaging and other biomarkers are going to be critically important to help us develop the drugs. And then I think they'll translate in some form or fashion into the real world where the actual care of patients takes place, either to make sure that the diagnosis is made more accurately or diagnosis is made earlier, or that we have a way to track changes over time and determine whether medication is working or not. And if it's not working, maybe there's a different one that the patient may respond to. So there's a lot of, I see a rosy future. I've been more excited now than I have been in years over the changes that have happened in the past year. So it's a very heady time, if you'll excuse the pun.
You're sending us into the new year with a lot of hope. There is really rapid progress, and I've been at the Fox Foundation for 10 years, less time in Parkinson's than our panelists, but I agree there's a lot to be optimistic about with the speed of progress. To close us out, last comment from Dr. Sharp, could you take us through the big important takeaway? Where is PD imaging today, and what does the community need to know about imaging in Parkinson's?
I think the big takeaway is that there's a lot in the pipeline. So I think we already use imaging in ways that are useful clinically and useful for research. And I think we'll be able to get a lot more out of it. And what's really exciting about the imaging piece, in addition to some of these other tests that we've been talking about, like the test from the lumbar puncture or maybe from blood sometime soon, is that it allows us to actually look at the organ, the brain, that is affected by the disease and that is causing the symptoms. And so I think that's why there continues to be so much interest in finding ways that we can optimally use the images that we can capture from MRI, PET, or SPECT. So I think the takeaway is really that there's a lot in the research pipeline for measurements that will be useful in research and eventually for patients in the clinical setting too.
Fantastic. Dr. Sharp, Dr. Seibel, Peter, thank you for joining us today. Thank you to the audience for tuning in, and we'll look forward to seeing you back here next year. Thanks all.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Did
Did you enjoy this podcast? Share it with a friend or leave a review on iTunes. It helps listeners like you find and support our mission. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation at michaeljfox.org. Thanks for listening.
This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.